I don't fail. No, I failed so many times. But, you know, with failure, particularly like cost plus drugs, you iterate, you learn and you iterate. Like I tell every kid I talk to, doesn't matter how many times you fail, you only got to be right one time. Then everybody can call you an overnight success. What I do well is I'm okay with mistakes.
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. Mark Cuban might be most famous for his time on Shark Tank, or maybe for being the former outspoken owner of the Dallas Mavericks. But in health circles, he's known for his backing of the online pharmacy Cost Plus Drugs, which sells drugs direct from the manufacturer to consumers with a transparent markup. And of course, Mark is a charismatic character, so I expected this conversation to be both entertaining and interesting. But what I didn't expect was for him to lay out such a clear and repeatable approach for taking overhead, complexity, and cost out of the U.S. healthcare system. Here's the basic formula so you can be listening for it. First, get purchasers, that's Medicare or employers, to directly negotiate clear and fair prices with drug companies and hospitals. Then, remove copays and deductible payments for patients that use these directly contracted services. The result? Clear and fair prices for patients and purchasers. No partial payments or prior authorization for providers, and disintermediation of the middlemen, whether PBMs or insurance companies. So please welcome Mark Cuban to The Other 80. My first question to guests is always, what should we know about them? Because often there's something important inside the story. But I want to ask you a slightly different question, which is, what do people get wrong about you?
I think they look at my bank account, because whenever somebody sees something written about me, they always say, billionaire Mark Cuban. And I'm not sad to be a billionaire, but I think people use that and their perception of what that means to decide what I'm about and what I'm like. And, you know, my bank account does not define me, didn't define me when I was broke, sleeping on the floor, and doesn't define me now.
And what does?
I think what I'm trying to accomplish, that, you know, that I'm trying to give something back, that I'm trying to spend as much time as I can with my family while, you know, my kids are still accessible to me and not off on their own. I'm trying to build a business that helps people. I just try to do the right thing as best I can.
Some people have called Cost Plus Drugs so obvious it's radical, which I think is a sad testament about the state of healthcare. Yeah. Is it radical? What made it possible?
What makes it radical is when we started, everybody presumed and expected that we would work within the system, that we would partner with the big three wholesalers that control 98% of the sale of drugs, that we would partner with the big three PBMs that control 85% of prescriptions. And we did the exact opposite because we knew they were the problem, right? And by working with them and having any level of dependency on them, that we couldn't be disruptive. And so that was part one. Part two to costplusdrugs.com is we show our costs. And so when you go to costplusdrugs.com and you put in the name of the medication, presuming it's one of the thousands we carry, when it comes up, you see exactly what we pay. You see our markup, which is always 15%. And then there's $5 for shipping and pharmacy fee. And so it's that being that transparent was radically different and truly has changed the game.
One of the things that's confounding this market is often the big health plans that are purchasing in, you know, care and drugs for most Americans who are employed are also the owners of PBMs, interestingly. And so
shocking.
You don't see a lot of, right? Shocking. So it's perhaps not surprising that those big national insurers aren't the ones leading the charge on trying to disrupt that market. How do you go about disrupting that other than through your model?
There are 161 million people covered by self-insured employers. You know, I've disrupted multiple industries, and healthcare has been the easiest to disrupt. And the reason for that is I can go to a CEO knowing that they don't really understand their benefits, right? It's not their core competency. They're trying to run a company, but it also is their second largest expense item after payroll. And it's becoming more and more evident that it's a problem for them. this is the first time ever where I can say, no, it's better and it's cheaper. And it's just a question of you going through the process. Now, for some, that's more work than they want to deal with. For others, they're addicted to the rebates from the PBMs and they don't care about the impact on their members. They just like getting that check. And then I explain to them that it's your sickest employees that pay for those rebates because they have to continually utilize medications that offer rebates. And most corporate accounts have, sponsors have $1,500 to $2,500 deductibles, which isn't enormous, relatively speaking. But for a lot of people, if your take-home pay is $30,000, $40,000, that's a big number. And if you're using this as an example, if you have a $2,000 deductible and you have Eliquis, which is a $600 WAC price, list price, you're paying $600 a month for 3 months. And whatever the rebate on that is, probably 50, 60%, is going right into the pocket of the PBM / insurance company. So because of this deal you signed, on one hand, you're complaining that healthcare costs and pharmacy costs are going up faster than you ever expected. But on the other hand, you're signing the deals that are causing them to go up so quickly. You know, the first thing I always tell them to do, and I suggest this to everybody, just go to your PBM and say you'd like to add cost plus drugs to your network and that you'll only use it where we're cheaper. There's no exclusivity. There's no requirements. It's not like a PBM and their specialty pharmacies. Cost plus drugs doesn't have exclusives with anybody. So if we're cheaper, right, that just benefits your members. And they always go and they ask and they always get told no. No one's ever been told yes. And the PBMs then give you 15 different reasons why they do this, 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 why they're cheaper. Then I'm like, if they're cheaper, ask for the per claim price. Go ahead and just ask them for all your claims. And if you're like 500,000 members or more, you probably have all this. But everybody else, you can have thousands of members, 10,000 members, and you won't have all your claims and you certainly won't have a net price per claim. You certainly won't know what the net rebates are. And I tell them to go ask and they get told no, or they're told, here's 300 claims. And then I say, go, here's a company that'll audit them, right? And every single audit I've ever seen, there's never been one time where the company got overpaid. Then I ask the last question, what is it about the big PBMs that is unique or differentiated that isn't available elsewhere? If you have one thing, raise your hand. Nobody's ever raised their hand. That's how bad it is. And so it's just our job to educate the people who make the decisions, and not just in employers. Like I was talking to a state today and they were complaining to me about the PBMs and the insurance companies. And I'm like, which one do you deal with? And they list one of the ones. I'm like, you're not allowed to complain if you're signing deals with these people because you're creating this problem because you're a huge state with all these members and you're making it more difficult for all your members. And then I went with them. I went through the whole, deductible and how you're paying list price while you're on your deductible. If you're able as a state or as an employer to require net pricing as opposed to WAC pricing with rebates, then all of this changes. The whole dynamic changes and your employees will be paying a net price plus a little markup versus the retail price at twice as much, if not more. And so it's, to answer your question, and sorry for the long-winded answer, it's more about the fact that employers, states, all the people who make these decisions don't understand how the economics work. So they sign bad deals.
I'm going to ask you to look back and look forward. Tell us at the first moment this occurred to you. This was not an obvious pathway for you if you look at your history. What was the moment where you're like, gosh darn it, this is one I have to figure out?
Gosh darn it is what I was not what I said to myself.
But this is a clean podcast. I don't want to change my rating.
You're right. I got an email, a cold email from a Dr. Alex Oshmiansky, who's now my co-founder. And he wanted to start a compounding pharmacy that manufactures sterile injectables for that were on short supply. Because there's always a short supply list and some drugs that you never expect, sterile water, Pitocin, pediatric cancer drugs, often go into short supply. So I was like, that's a good idea. I'm open to that. But let me dig in some more and understand this industry more and answer my questions. And this was right around the time the Pharma Bro was going to jail. And so I was like, how could this dude raise the price of this generic drug, Daraprim, by 7,500% or whatever it was? And then I started digging and I was like, this is the most opaque industry that I've ever seen in my entire life. This is like easy pickings. If we just create a website and we're able to buy drugs from a manufacturer and just are completely transparent about everything, I'm like, why don't we show our cost? Why don't we show our markup? Well, we're leaving money on the table. That's okay, because every patient that does this will benefit, and there will be patients who otherwise couldn't afford their medications who now can get it and may not have to ration and can be healthy. It's worth it, right? It'll take us longer to make money, but that's okay. And so on January 19th of 2022, almost 4 years ago, we started Cost Plus Drugs with 111 drugs. And let me just take one step back. Right around that same time we were launching, I got our 111 drugs, took the ones that had that cost $30 or more, and then with a lot of arm twisting, got our, for the Dallas Mavericks, got our claims and the prices paid for all the generics that we were buying. And I only used the ones costing $30 or more. The Mavs over an 18-month period spent $169,000. The cost at Cost Plus would have been $19,000.
Wow.
I'm like, okay, this is the right path. This is definitely the right way. And I did a couple TV shows and promotions and talked about it. And immediately we were getting people who were buying cancer drugs that were saving hundreds of dollars a month, if not more. I mean, I had one friend from college who lost his insurance and had a drug called Dropadoza. And he's like, Mark, they're telling me I'm going to have to pay $10,000 every 3 months. And I'm like, let me check. We were just getting started, hadn't carried it yet. We got it. And at that point in time, his price, I forget exactly, like $79 a month is what we got him for. And he was crying. And then we got the price down lower as we grew. And so it was just those types of inefficiencies that we were able to solve. Once we launched and saw our initial volume, and then just the feedback and responses we got, I knew we were on the right path.
I love that it came from a cold email, because you responded very quickly to my email. You do not know me.
Yeah.
5 years from now, where do you want to be?
We want to have the entire healthcare industry be 180 degrees different. We want there to be complete transparency. We want to carry all drugs. You know, there's certain brands that won't sell to us for a variety of reasons. We want to have an impact on medical care as well. We're working on direct contracting programs for my members, the members that I self-insure and pay for. And we think we may be able, maybe not get all the way there, obviously, but have a significant impact. You know, it's not like I have to make a lot of money. If I just turn this industry upside down so that people just match our prices, because there's a lot of people who don't buy their drugs from costplusdrugs.com, but have their PBMs or their insurers have to match our pricing. Like when I just gave the Senate testimony last week, one of the things that the guy from CalPERS said, Dr. Mold said, was we use Cost Plus Drugs price list in our negotiations with the PBMs, which got us lower pricing. And that happens all the time. And that's one of the reasons the PBMs and insurance companies hate us, because the smartest thing we did was publish our price list and make it available to everybody. So now, you know, research organizations can look and see, you know, that for, I forget which kind of, this list of medications, Medicare would have saved $6 billion if they would have bought through Cost Plus. For oncology drugs, $900 million, et cetera. Corporations are doing the same thing, and they're going back to their PBMs, and their PBMs are now having to give them more in rebates or pass-throughs or reduced fees. But, you know, so it's paying off. Unfortunately, the PBMs are smarter than the CEOs and the people doing the negotiations, because they just changed fees. And I tell everybody now, if you have a PBM contract or insurance contract, stick it into Gemini, Perplexity, and ChatGPT, and just say, what am I missing? What am I not noticing on this contract that's bad for me? And it'll pop up great stuff.
So you kind of alluded to looking around healthcare and seeing other opportunities disrupt. If you were to pick another sector or subsector within healthcare that has similar disruption opportunities, what would it be and why? And how would you get going?
Well, we're starting something called Cost Plus Wellness, which is for my own companies, the members that I, because I self-insure, and so I'm responsible for paying. It's left pocket, right pocket for me. And it was always, just as it was insane that the farmer bro could jack up Daraprim, it's crazy to me that the biggest insurance companies, when you look at the price transparency files for hospitals, their prices are sometimes two or three times as much as any John Doe walking into a provider with a credit card to pay cash. And so I started telling our people, you know, before, unless it's an emergency and you have to go now, let us call, get the cash price, and we'll just pay with the company credit card. And that saved me a bunch of money. So I'm like, we need to formalize this. And so direct contracts have been—
Hold on a minute. So you're a big employer. All of these organizations would be happy to have your business. Your person shows at the door. And if they say they're with the company, the charge is going to be 10 times higher than if they're an individual. I mean, we've all experienced this when we go pay for drugs and they accidentally give us the price.
The cash price, yeah. Yeah.
It's such an illogical statement you just said. I mean, what you did is brilliant, but the—
It makes no sense at all that the biggest insurance companies that do hundreds of billions of dollars in sales can't negotiate a better price than anybody who walks in the door with a credit card that does no negotiation whatsoever. And when I would talk to hospital CEO and CFOs and ask them to tell me about what it's like to deal with the insurance companies and the problem issues, you start digging in and it's insane, right? Not just a cash pay. So the reason we're able to do direct contracting is because the hospitals get abused by the insurance companies in a lot of ways. Not always, because sometimes the hospital will have more power in a given market, but most of the time, and here's the way it works. The contracted price with the insurance company is $25,000. Somebody who's covered goes in to get a hip replacement. You would think they just pay $25,000, but they don't. They underpay you and basically say, if you don't like it, sue me. And so now the provider, the hospital network, loses 3 to 5% just because of those underpayments. And they have all these administrators and lawyers who have to deal with it trying to collect it, right? The prior authorizations aren't just about denying care, it's about delaying care. Because the longer they have your premium money, the more interest that they can earn that the provider hasn't been paid yet and doesn't earn. And by the way, the hospital and the provider have doctors that are wasting all this time trying to get the denial overturned so their patient can get the care that they've chosen or prescribed, right? So all these things add up from the hospital or provider's perspective as being very cost heavy. And that's why we hear all these stories about administration fees and overhead costing 20 to 30% of the $5 trillion we spend every year. It's all those things. So we went to hospitals and we said, we want your cash price. And where you don't have a cash price, because there's not one for everything, we want to pay some percentage of Medicare. It could be 80% if it's an MRI. It could be 120%. It could be 150%. We'll negotiate with all the different providers, and we're not going to be exclusive to any. But here's the key. By the time our patient has gotten to you, there's no pre-auths. We've already ascertained whether or not we're going to pay for it. So your doctors waste no time, right? And you get the money. We're going to pay you right away. And we're going to pay you exactly what we negotiated for. There's no underpayment, none of those games, no administrative burden to deal with it. And they like it. And so far, we're up to 9,000 doctors/providers. And we called this program Cost Plus Wellness. And here's the money shot, though. What's key is we're going to take all those contracts we negotiate, and we're going to publish them on costpluswellness.com so that any company can look at it. Any individual can look at it.
Just as an anecdote, my friend Dave DeBroncard is one of the most amazing patient innovators I know. Needed a Mohs surgery or something. And he tried to get prices. He called around. And they basically said, they actually said, we don't know our prices. Like, we can't give you a price.
Well, no, it's even worse than that. They don't know their costs.
Yeah.
Like, I paid for a study. Now, this has been 5-6 years ago, where I was part of a study in this case. And I asked them to have kids just call up hospitals and ask for the cash price and compare it to the published cash price. And like 60% of the time, you know, whatever it was, it didn't match. We want it to be radically transparent. We don't sell it. We just make it available. And it's not launched yet, but hopefully by the end of the year, costpluswellness.com will have all these contracts.
Will you also manage that process for other employers that might want to work with you?
No, we're just, they'll be in consultants. We're not, this is not a business for us. This is us publishing this data for anybody to use as they will, but we're expecting two things will happen. One, when we publish all the cash prices, we'll get a lot of grief because other companies will have gotten better pricing and we'll be able to go back to those providers and say, they're getting better pricing over here, right? What would you like us to do? Because we're not exclusive to any of them and we can shop. And so, you know, the other thing, what we are recommending to employers is that they hire a healthcare CEO who is kind of a care navigator, that all they do is act as the pre-authorization and negotiator for anything that's expensive for your members. So if you need a surgery, you know, let's go find a doctor that you like if you don't already have one. And if you do have one, let us negotiate with your doctor to see if I can get a cash price. And if you do this, there will be no cash out of pocket to you.
I mean, they all have health benefits managers today, the bigger companies. How would the healthcare CEO be different from that person?
You're negotiating for the self-insured employer. And all I have to do is save money, enough money on one surgery that, you know, each a month, right, that I'm paying for this person. And it just makes it easier. And obviously, like our employees, we're using this now, love it when they have the choice. Like, if we can't negotiate something better, we'll still let them use their current doctor, but they'll have a deductible, whatever our standard deductible is. And if they let us negotiate, no deductible. And it's like the same thing on pharmacy. If you get your drugs from Cost Plus Drugs, then there's no deductible, no copay, no insurance.
I'm going to zoom out a little bit. You've tackled a certain corner of healthcare, but there's so much that's tackleable. And without asking you to take on all those pieces, I'd love your perspective.
I'm trying.
As an entrepreneur. Sure. I know, you'll get there. You'll get there. And the first is, you've said that capitalism can do good for healthcare when incentives align, but the hard truth is they rarely do. I think Kaiser is a model where they mostly do. If we were to design capitalism for actual health, what would be your working rules for that?
So if I was in charge, right?
Yes.
I'm in charge. the first thing you do is you make these huge insurance companies divest everything and disaggregate them. You can't keep anything over some number, $25 billion in revenue, whatever it may be. Because when you're that big and you have hundreds of billions in revenue, you get to game the system. The way we regulate and review and manage healthcare is by silo, right? Here's our pharmacy, here's our health, medical, here's what we do here, here's what we do there. And when it's vertical for these big insurance companies or big providers, they're playing in multiple pots, multiple silos, so they can game the system and leverage the inefficiencies because they can always move and acquire much more quickly than regulators or even companies can move. Because this is all they think about day and night, and they have people analyzing this day and night, whereas regulators, politicians, employers, they can't move that fast. So game number one is to divest and disaggregate all these companies and make sure it stays that way. And I think when you do that, a lot of good things will start to happen. I think number two would be in terms of networks, right? That there are no networks, that you just deal with your published price. And if I want to work with, you know, ABC Insurance Company, and that's their published price at Baylor Scott White or UPMC or Mayo Clinic, great. I can go wherever and my insurance company will pay that, or if I pay the cash price, I have either option. When you take away the networks, you take away the gating effect where you're seeing, particularly with Medicare Advantage, where they just make the network smaller and smaller so that patients have less care and more things are off network, which allows them to game the system and charge more. Now, there's more limits on what they can charge out of network, but they're still gaming the system in a variety of different ways. And then on hospitals, if you're nonprofit, you got to show, and this would never happen, but if you're nonprofit, you have to show every general ledger entry. So I put on my accounting hat And, you know, you say you don't understand your costs or you don't know why you're not making money on Medicaid, Medicare, right? Well, I call BS, because there are hospitals that can make money on Medicaid and Medicare. And so we're going to find out what it is about you that prevents it. If you want nonprofit, if you don't, pay your taxes.
One of the levers you've talked about is putting more decision-making in the hands of physicians and potentially more money in their hands. I want to push back against that for two reasons. One, compared to other countries, we pay our docs a lot more already. That's one of the—
Not compared to Canada.
But compared to OECD countries, where it's about 10% of our cost excess compared to those countries. A second, though, is we still see a lot of bad care delivered and variation of care delivered across docs. I mean, some are doing amazing jobs following protocols and really delivering the best care. Others aren't. So I'd love your answer on both of those issues, on whether that's a substantial cost driver and how to deal with it. And second, how do you deal with this question of actually making sure we get good care delivered by the—
Sure. A couple great questions. One, in terms of what we pay doctors, I want my doctors playing golf on Wednesday. I want them to be completely rested, you know, whenever they do any type of surgery or see patients, whatever it may be. I want them paid more, but the way to pay them more may not be, you know, by giving them more money, but it may well be by making med school free, public med schools free, because we don't necessarily get the best candidates, the best doctors. We get the ones that are willing to take on the obligation for their debt or who can afford to pay outright or may get scholarships, right? The first step is, okay, you know, make public medical schools free. Make sure you have at least one in every region. And just say, if you want it free, there's some stipulations. You have to work in primary care. You have to work in a healthcare desert, da, 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 da. And if you choose to do so, free. If you don't, fine. That's your choice. So that's first and foremost. I think that's where things can really make a change. The other side, in terms of improving care, I think AI is going to go a long way towards doing that. There is nobody that is a frequent user of ChatGPT or any of the models that doesn't put all their healthcare information in there just to ask questions. And I'm not saying they're all right, but you have the option of putting the same question or things your doctor have says in multiple models to compare the outputs. Now, a lot of them were trained on the same thing, but you can go to like openevidence.com and other similar sites that are geared towards doctors. And I do it all the time. And I'll tell you, I take levothyroxine and I also take an iron supplement. I had no idea I shouldn't take them at the same time until I put it in ChatGPT. And I think that will keep people honest. You don't need that third back surgery, right? And here's what everybody says and this and that. You know, like in my case, take all your medications and just ask what's the best time to take them, because do they step, or supplements you're taking, do they step on each other? You know, should you have calcium when you're taking, you know, iron, da, 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 da. Not every doctor is going to remember all that stuff. It's impossible. You can't expect them to. And you're going to make little mistakes, and hopefully they're not big mistakes. But AI, I think, will help regulate that and make doctors more effective.
For so many years, I was part of the government in trying to make sure patients had access to their own data, right? Making sure you can download your records.
Thank you for that. Yep.
But it was pushing a rock up a hill, because, like, what do people want with their data? But now there's finally a place to put it and something to do with it. But I've also wondered, if wouldn't it be awesome if you could— somebody in my family, for instance, wants to go on GLP-1s, but it's not covered by the insurance. So they're, you know, you could go and just buy it directly. But really, you want someone to guide that decision making. And so I feel like there's going to be a new business that's helping people take their data, understand what it means, and then guide how they would go back to their doctors and even help them negotiate with that.
For sure. I mean, that's what a lot of telehealth companies are trying to do, right? Here's, you know, send your blood results, give us your family history. If you're using Apple Health, you know, export it and send it to me. Let me review it and let me guide you through it. And, you know, I think that's inevitable. And that's smart. Right now, I think it's smarter to work with your family practitioner or, you know, your primary care doctor, because you want the continuity of care, so they know, you know, what works and what doesn't work together and know who you are. But in any way you can get access to smarter information, that's a win.
I've spent a lot of time in Medicaid, and it's a very rough time right now. There'll be massive cuts across the board. And I've talked to a lot of Medicaid policymakers who are just sort of just trying to stay afloat, honestly, and trying to figure out what to do, really afraid of the coverage losses. But I've talked to others who said, you know, this is a moment to rethink the way we deliver things. This is a moment to simplify. This is a moment to cut costs. This is a moment to take a sacred cow and just like really question it. And so if you had a room full of Medicaid policymakers who were willing to take some of those steps, what would you tell them to do?
The uncertainty with Medicaid is the cost of care and the lies that are told by providers that they can't afford to give the care and they don't want to participate because, you know, like I mentioned earlier, if you don't know your cost, you know, you don't know how to allocate the piano, the pianist, and the artwork that's in the foyer that you just built, right? Even if you're, you know, a hospital of last resort, maybe you don't have all that stuff, but there's still stuff, right, to allocate. And so the first thing I would do is say, you know, you if you want any federal dollars at all, you have to submit to an intensive audit. And that's where AI would come in and help. I just take all their general ledger entries, everything. Not here's a report for you from the hospital. Not here's our transparency report. Not here's our community report. Here's everything we spent a penny or more on, and I run it through and I do an analysis and I keep on training AI to make me smarter in that analysis. It's hard for traditional hospital operators to think and act like that. I've looked at buying some small rural hospitals and I talked to one recently and I wanted all that detail and they wouldn't provide it. You know, they wanted just give us money or loan us money and we'll run it the way we run it. And then I talk to people who have run hospitals that made money on Medicaid, and they're like, yeah, it's not hard to do. You just have to be very disciplined in how you do it. You know, and that, and as I'm thinking out loud here, right? So if just a family practice doctor that has to file all the forms for insurance, all the forms, you know, for all of this stuff, right? They can't now afford to take a Medicaid patient. Not because it's impossible to be able to make money off a Medicaid patient and Medicaid rates, but because of the overhead that's introduced by all the others that they take. So maybe you hire, you know, doctors and you pay them enough to pay off their debt and make some money. And you say, you are our Medicaid, you know, you are our Medicaid doctors. We are going to funnel them to you. We'll keep you busy. We'll hire as many as we need. Because that's effectively what companies, big companies are doing. You know, they're hiring physicians to be on site. They're putting clinics on site. And oh, by the way, you know, the health clinics are making money. Now they get subsidized for better or worse, right? But if you can put together the business plan and P&L and balance sheet for providers and hospitals that can make money at Medicaid rates, which by definition means they can make money at Medicare rates, then focus only on them, because as I mentioned earlier, the catch-22 is when you try to serve all masters. You get top-heavy in your administrative costs because you're dealing with these insurance companies that pay the higher rates when your net profit is possibly lower, but that preempts you because those six administrators that you have that are doing all the paperwork and all the systems that you have that deal with all the paperwork make it so you can't afford to do Medicaid.
I've been thinking a lot about the abundance agenda, which is essentially how do we deregulate to make it easier to build housing, or how do we get rid of policies?
All the above, right? Yeah, the laws, it's the innovator's dilemma for politicians.
Yeah, and it's interesting because all of those rules are in place for a reason. There, you can't point to a rule and not say, oh yeah, that makes sense. But when you take a step back and look at the system as a whole, it's really broken. And
right, and plus the fact there, that yeah. It was passed in 1975 or 85 or 95 or 2005. There was no AI back then. There was a different world back then, and you were protecting against whatever the hot item was in the news at that point in time. Every law should have a term limit, every single law.
I want to be in the room the first time a hospital actually gives you all their cost data and try to figure out what happens. You buck conventional wisdom and disrupt.
I try.
What's the time you failed, and what did that teach you about how to do it next time?
I don't fail.
Didn't succeed.
No, I've failed so many times. But you know, with failure, particularly like cost plus drugs, you iterate, you learn, and you iterate. You know, in terms of businesses, like I tell every kid I talk to, doesn't matter how many times you fail, you only got to be right one time, then everybody can call you an overnight success. And I think what I do well is I'm okay with mistakes. I'll try, like when I was just learning the pharmacy industry, oh my God, all the acronyms and all, I sounded like an idiot half the time. Because, you know, like when I put on my Shark Tank hat, I can look at any business and understand it immediately, simply because most businesses act the same way. You buy for one price, you mark it up, you sell it, you know what your costs are if it's a service, you try to make money, offer good customer support, whatever it may be to keep everybody happy. Pharmacy doesn't give a shit if you're happy, right? The manufacturers do, but the wholesalers don't. They, you know, they charge whack prices to their pharmacies, and the pharmacies pay overpay, and they're waiting on reimbursements from the PBM who don't care if they survive or not, and their CEOs have said so. I mean, it is just a back-ass half-words industry, particularly on the pharmacy side. And on the medical side, like all the things that I mentioned, but in response to all those things, the providers and the hospitals in particular have to invent new forms of revenue. So they create these things called facilities fees, which makes no sense in the history of sense that they should have facilities fees. But they're relatively new because they're getting, you know, extorted from the insurance companies who are trying to find more ways to extract revenue from them. So the hospitals and providers have to find new ways to extract revenue from whoever they can, whether it's an insurance company, a corporate payer, you know, which is more likely, or the patient themselves. And so you've got to disintermediate all these pieces and make them stand alone and look where the leverage points are. The FTC and the DOJ need to take a look. And these things, they're hard to legislate, but common sense-wise, they're easy to fix. You know, and like you've been on the inside of government and seen the sausage made, you know, like you said, it's pushing a rock up a hill. But those are the things that need to change. Because if on one hand, you get these huge companies that are just getting bigger and you don't stop it at all, it's regulatory capture by scale.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen that in hospital pricing too, obviously. Like in Boston, why are prices so high? Well, some of it's Harvard, but some of it's, they're all two, three networks.
I loved it when hospitals sponsored stuff with the Mavs, but pass it on to patients, you know?
Exactly.
You know, I get branding. When you're in a competitive market, you want your brand to stand out. You added that oncology department and you paid the best oncologist you could find and everybody you needed so you could say that you're the best and you want to promote that and you want to charge a premium for it. Great. Have at it. But you should be nonprofit.
Yes.
You know, and you if you're not going to participate in Medicare, Medicaid, DISH, get your DISH payment, da-da-da-da-da, let's realize that and focus on the hospitals and providers that will and get them focused. You know, now that I think about it, doesn't it make perfect sense to have designated Medicaid/Medicare providers that you actually support, you know, economically with either sending them more business or by saying to them, we don't, if you want to be this designated provider, we don't want you dealing with insurance companies because those insurance companies jack up your costs to deal with administration. The fact that you have to deal with all the overhead associated with the insured patients means you're never going to make money or much money on Medicaid and Medicare. And you just made me come to that realization.
Okay, we're going to be watching for the new strategy there.
I'll be talking about it a lot now. Okay. Unless you tell me I got it all wrong.
No. I mean, I have a lot of questions, but I think that's where you start with these things, you know.
Yeah.
Two quick final questions. One, what is your own personal health routine?
I try to work out 5-6 times a week, and I do HIIT workouts with people half my age, play, shoot basketball with my 16-year-old, try to eat well. I write everything down in my Fitness Pal. So everything I eat, I don't get it exactly right, but I try to get calories right so that I, you know, try to consume less than I expend. You know, and I try to just do all the wellness things. I'm not a huge supplement guy, except like melatonin when I sleep and that type of thing, and the iron for my iron deficiency. But, and then I try to eat healthy. You know, I try not to, you know, eat fried foods, no processed foods, you know, try to, you know, even when I'm out to eat, ask for just, you know, plain grilled salmon or whatever it may be. I just really try to, because now at my age, you know, your body is less resilient as we get older, right? So I've got to be more diligent if I want to be able to keep up with my kids.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, I used to drink. I rarely, unless I'm out with my kids, I don't drink. And so, you know, I just really try to be diligent in what I do. And I still eat food I like, and I just find foods that I like that are clean and healthy. That's all.
And finally, you have a lot of courage and willingness to say things that others feel afraid to. And at the School of Public Health, our training, what we hope will be the next generation of change makers. How can they develop that sense of bravery and courage?
I don't think I'm brave or have courage. I think when you work inside the system, you have to watch what you say. When you're in the outside of the system trying to disrupt, you can't say what you're supposed to say. You have to say what people don't want to hear and are afraid to hear and might make you seem stupid and will get you a lot of criticism because you're outside the system trying to, you know, break the incumbents, you know, trying to put them into the innovator's dilemma, right? So I don't think I'm brave or courageous by in the least bit, but because I've always worked outside the system, I could just rail on the people who, you know, do it the way it's always been done. Whenever I see something that's been done the same way for an extended period of time, whether that's 2 years, 5 years, 10, 20, whatever it may be, that's always an invitation for disruption.
Well, that's a great place to end. Thank you, Mark Cuban.
Thanks, Claudia. It was great. I really enjoyed the questions.
People have called Mark's approach to reducing drug costs so obvious, it's radical. So what made it hard for the folks within the system, drug companies, PBMs, and insurance companies, to do it before him? Remember Clay Christensen's Innovator's Dilemma? That applies here. Those organizations were blinded and cornered by their own economic incentives and existing business structures. Mark Cuban succeeded by making change from outside the system. And I think we can all take a note here. If we're looking to make big shifts, we may not be able to do it from inside. And we don't have to start with a big idea. Sometimes we can start with a simple question. Why does it have to work this way? This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore-Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on Mark Cuban and Cost Plus Drugs. There is more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.